Hi, everyone. My name is Adam Small.
And I'm Jake Moses.
Welcome to our podcast, The Performer's Pathway.
A podcast adventure to help guide and navigate your musical life and career.
As a prelude to every episode, we'd like to remind our listeners that this podcast is about the other side of the musical coin. One side, which you see a lot at our website, mymusicmasterclass.com, is what to do in the practice room. The other side is how to maximize your talent and skills in the real world, and that's what this podcast is about. Also, if you have a few extra seconds to spare,
which is technically only 3 beats at 60 BPM,
please subscribe to our show on your podcast app of choice and rate us 5 stars. You can leave a comment about absolutely anything, too. That small act of kindness will really help us expand our audience and continue to create new episodes.
And lastly, word of mouth is always super helpful. So if you like what you hear, please tell the world.
Welcome, everyone. We're here for our podcast today, and we have a special guest, and it's going to be hard to keep this one professional because I've known this guy for way too long. I actually counted before, Ian. It was, I think it's 25 years.
Yeah, that's pretty, pretty absurd.
Yeah, man. It's absurd. So anyway, this is Ian Hendrickson-Smith. We played together for many, many years. We still do. We had this band called Hot Pants. Ian's a great saxophone player. When I was playing with Ian a while back, he mainly played alto, but he plays Barry. He plays tenor. He does all that stuff. He's a mad flute player too. But he's done quite a bit since then, you know, and along with it as we've known each other. He's been he's now in the Roots, so he does the Fallon gig. He's on Jimmy Fallon, which is at home right now, I'm assuming. Also, he was in the Dap Kings for years and did a bunch of records with a lot of different people. And we're happy to have him on the show. How is your quarantine going, my friend?
You know, it's interesting. There's a certain part of me that enjoys being home with my wife and my dog.
Right.
You know, about 4 years ago, I bought a house in Brewster, upstate New York. And I really haven't been here that much because I've been, you know, either at 30 Rock or touring. So this is the first stretch of time I've had here for more than like a day or two at a time. So that part I'm enjoying. The part that is tricky is, you know, is worrying about all my friends in the city and cats that are, you know, out of work and stuff. So that part is obviously stressful and, you know, but
right.
Overall, it's you know, on a purely selfish tip, it's been great. I've been practicing a lot and doing a lot of work for the Tonight Show and doing some remote studio sessions and doing a little bit of teaching and, you know, mm-hmm. just staying super busy.
Yeah, I saw you play with, actually texted you. I saw you play with Sting on the Fallon show and you had a pillow, I believe. And I think Dave Guy had Converse or something like that, right?
Yeah, sounds right.
Yeah. So that's the kind of work you're doing these days.
Well, it's those little bits like that. And then, they're asking us for new commercial bumpers.
Oh, I see.
So we're like, you know, recording and doing video stuff like mad right now.
Right.
It's like, you know, 15 tunes a day sometimes we're recording, you know, and it goes much slower with this process of not mm-hmm. all being in the same room, you know.
Yeah, I can imagine, man.
Yeah.
Your video chops are getting better.
Ha, it's getting there, yeah. Getting there.
Is there like a new job title for music director in that sort of thing, if it's all digital and oh, webcam true. Stuff?
It's like digital music.
You know what I mean, something. Though? Because that's a whole different kind of thing.
You know, not that I really am aware of. There's a guy at the show named John McDonald who would occasionally, you know, and during normal situation when we're at 30 Rock, I wouldn't see him that much. He would show up if there was like a musical bit that required charts or mm-hmm. if there was like a bigger horn section or something, he would show his face and hand some stuff to us. But now he's in our purview, like, you know, constantly. So
that's cool.
He has more to do with kind of making sure that things are getting done that need to get done and et cetera, yeah. et cetera.
Like I said, I've known you forever. I mean, we went to Manhattan School of Music together originally. From there, we've just been hanging, But you've always had a lot of irons in the fire, and this is kind of one of the things we've talked about on the podcast. I talk about kind of diversifying your stock portfolio, you know, but not with money, because, you know, musicians don't have any. But I'm sorry, that was a terrible joke. But, you know, more about like diversifying your portfolio with music. And you've always done that. You've always, you know, mixed your own audio, done all your own graphics, done things for other people as well in the same realm, mixed other people's records. I mean, I'm sure you don't have as much time as you used to, but coming up, I did a lot of the same thing. And so you always had a lot of skills. Plus, you know, you're a jazz musician, but you always played pop gigs in different realms, and, you know, a lot of soul stuff and a lot of different scenes, whereas some other friends we have were more purist, and it becomes tough, you know? So I guess the question is, how do you feel that this set you up for kind of where you are now? Because I know that people probably ask you, how do you get a talk show gig, or like, a, you know, and there's no answer for that really, except for what I just said. Like, how do you think you were set up for that? Besides, you know, it falling out of the sky.
Well, that's a great question. Probably a long-winded answer. I'll try to be as succinct as I can. But
well, my question was like all over the place, so you can
yeah,
be as
it's
long
pretty
as
rambling,
that.
Honestly. But you know, yeah. The jack of all trades thing, or Renaissance man, whatever, you know, however you want to label it. I got into all that stuff primarily out of being a control freak, mm-hmm. and just that I didn't want anybody else touching my stuff.
Okay.
So I wanted to get those skills together so I could do things the way that I saw them or creatively, you know, wanted them to go. So the graphic design and the mixing and mastering and all that business was really just that. It was, and then I ended up, you know, falling in love with the process of that, of doing that stuff, and ended up working for a lot of other people. In recent years, I've been too busy just playing saxophone to do it as much as I was. I was the staff designer for a label called Cellar Live. Mm-hmm. I think I did probably, I don't know, maybe 100 layouts for him or something like that, which,
Corey,
you know,
yeah.
That's a, it's doesn't sound like a lot, but each, you know, each one of those records is probably 40, 50 hours, you know. Anyway, you know, the mixing and mastering, I still do it all the time, but it's just on a, usually it's like a track per track kind of situation. In terms of it's of that kind of stuff setting me up for what's happening now, you know, there is no magic equation or anything, but certainly every single option you have to put bread on your table through music is a good thing. And I'll be honest with you, like, I actually truly love all that work. Mixing and graphic yeah. design, like, I do it because I love it.
Yeah, I'm with you, man.
The obvious pitfall in any of this stuff is being a master of none. You know, you never want to have so much that you're trying to do that you lose the quality. I have had the privilege of getting to spend a lot of like very focused time on each of the instruments I play. So, you know, I started off on alto, and I started off on flute, technically, so I was originally a flute player. Then I switched to alto saxophone and had a good, you know, 10, 15 years where that's all I played, you know. And then the Dap Kings gig came about, and I can talk more about that if you want later, but I was playing primarily baritone with her, and that was a good 8 years.
With Sharon Jones, yeah.
Yeah, so that was 8 years of just playing baritone. You know, and the last six, it's been like 95% tenor.
Yeah, it's crazy,
so,
right?
You know, it's that kind of laser focus that you really start to zero in, like, okay, this is really the sound that I want. And you stop thinking like a doubler, and you start thinking like, okay, I'm a tenor saxophone player,
right? Right.
And now I'm an alto saxophone player, mm-hmm. and now it's not just like, oh, I'm a saxophone player that plays all the different instruments. It's like I actually really put down everything else for a period of time and only play baritone.
I want you to keep going with this, but is it hard to maintain all of your instruments? Like,
yes.
Because you need to keep them all good, because even with the Fallon show and with your own life, you might be asked for a bit to play flute, right?
Yes.
I mean, it could happen, right?
It is. It takes, yeah, I work really hard at that. So in the morning before I go to work, I usually take out, I have a set of horns at 30 Rock, which are there on ransom right now.
Right.
And then I have a set of horns at home. So at least, you know, a couple times a week, every horn here gets taken out of the case and played, and I make sure I have a good read. And I visit every instrument all the time, and I leave them out, you know, for the most part. You can't see my room right now, but I have two tenors, an alto, a flute, and a baritone out just like on stands over here. And so that's really helpful to just see them. You just grab one and slap a read on and go.
Right.
You know. But yeah, it's definitely a dedication to make sure that I maintain all those horns and feel comfortable. So, you know, because it can be the type of thing where I'll be on the train on the way to work and they're like, hey, you're playing with so-and-so and here's the song. You know, there's no chart and you don't know what instrument you're playing until you walk through the door, and then a half hour later you're taping, you know.
Right. You mentioned that to me before. There literally is no charts or anything, and you just have to learn it on the train. By the time you get there, how often or how long do you have to prepare? Like, do you shed with the guys? Or
sometimes you have like 60 seconds
right.
to prepare, and sometimes you have a couple hours, and you know, sometimes it can be
stressful,
like a little hammer came down your head, you know.
Right.
Yeah, you just, it's kind of sink or swim, and you just try your hardest to swim.
Right. Wow, that's great.
That's not great at all. It sounds terrifying.
It really can be. There's been times like you know, Amir Questlove has a laptop on set that's, you know, hooked up to Wi-Fi, and sometimes like we'll be in the middle of taping a show or something, and he'll be like, "Oh no, like that song didn't clear. We can't play that." And then he'll be like, "Let's play this instead." And he'll go on YouTube and like pull up like some Earth, Wind, and Fire thing, and it's like, you know, insane. Yeah, it can be sometimes it can be totally nuts.
It's like, but then.
Yeah, right. Everybody else has a little pedal they can hit, so that they can hear themselves and not the audience can't hear them. So they're over there working their lines out, and me and Dave are just like, we're SOL, man. Like, we can't make a single sound, or Jimmy will go nuts. You know? So we're over there just like, we're like begging someone to give us a key.
Yeah.
You know, just give me a starting point so we can like start to figure out what the first note is, and then
Oh my God.
I mean, it can be desperate. Like, we just figured the line out and he's like counting it off, and we're just, you know, just praying. And most, you know, we got that gig because 95% of the time it's right, you know. And
there's
that, you know, you just do your best.
So are there any considerations with the union? You have to be part of the union, right, to do this?
Correct.
And SAG?
I do get some SAG residuals, but I'm technically paid through the union.
Okay. So let's break into the Dap King portion of your life. You know, for years we played together in this band called Hot Pants with a bunch of great cats, Al Street, Jeremy Manasia, Adam Scone, Joe Strasser, Dave Gibson, Ian, and myself. Did I miss anyone? No, I think that's it. You know, at one point, and you were doing a lot of jazz gigs, you were always putting out your jazz records and doing that as well, and you got involved with Gabe and Neil, so Gabe Roth and Neil Sugarman, and kind of, how did that help you? Because I kind of know the answer to this, but it'd just be cool to talk about it. How did that open you up to basically the Roots gig, but even before that, you know, with all these records you've done? And Amy Winehouse as well, right?
Yes. That band was really unique. It's hard to even put it into words, like how special that band was, and I guess still is, but they're not really working much anymore. But really the way it was the stepping stone to everything that's happened after it, obviously. But I think the main point of it is it was such a purist thing. Like, it was so the intent of that band was almost even more like purist than like James Brown was in a certain way. It was like so like regimentedly pure.
Right.
And intentionally so. It was every note and every single second of that band was thought out and intentional. That being said, there was a certain amount of interest from like other producers, and namely Mark Ronson and Eli Wolf from Blue Note at the time. So, you know, the phone started to ring from people, you know, hearing that music and hearing the way it was recorded and hearing the way the band played. and it, knowing that we could do a very specific thing very well.
Right.
You know, and that's, you know, essentially that's how we ended up working with Ronson. And he's the one that hired us to do that Amy Winehouse record. And, you know, there was so many other records too. Lily Allen and
Al Green too, right?
Al Green. Yeah. We did the horn section did a full length record with Al Green called Lay It Down. Yeah. Lots of stuff. We did a remix thing with Bob Dylan. I mean, it was a crazy time. We're in the studio constantly.
Mm-hmm. And a quick aside, like, which is interesting. I think, did you tell me that the Amy Winehouse stuff was all you, right? Like they just said, do your thing. No, is that my wrong?
I mean, no, that's not 100% true. Oh, okay. No, Ronson working, that was kind of early on with our relationship with Mark. And at that time, now he's very, very specific. He'll usually show up to a session like we did that Uptown Funk song.
Oh, right.
And he, you know, he had like every note of that worked out for us. But on the Amy record, he'd be like, hey, I, you know, can you give me a vibe like this? And he'd kind of like,
I see,
push you in a certain direction, but he'd want us to more often than not end up crafting the lines ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then he would go from there and tweak it and take things away or add things. So it was very, very, you know, back and forth. It wasn't like, he wasn't giving us verbatim lines like he does now.
Right.
You
know? I see.
Yeah.
At that point, how did you meet the Roots? I mean, I kind of know the story, but it'd be interesting to take us that far.
You know, the Roots were, the initial introduction was through the Dap Kings. Mm-hmm. I think the first time I really got to meet, Questlove, was at the first annual Roots picnic, which is now, I think 15th year or something like that. I can't remember the exact number, but, it was, you know, some years ago, and it was, at that time it was a much smaller thing. It was like, you know, in a parking lot by the water in Philly, and it's maybe 500-600 people I think attended. Now it's like, you know, 25,000 or something like that show up to the Roots picnic.
That's big. So that's a big ass picnic.
Yeah, right.
Damn.
And I remember Quest introducing us because it must have been 2007 or something like that. So maybe 13, 14. I can't remember exactly, but I remember Quest introducing us, and it was in the middle of the summer. And we're all wearing suits, you know, just like sweating before we even played a note.
Yeah, of course.
And Quest walks out and introduces us, and he says, you know, before Amy, you know, this band has been doing this for a long time, and Sharon's one of the toughest, and blah blah blah. And,
yep, Sharon and wasn't she wasn't she a prison guard at Rikers?
She was, yeah. She was, and before that, she worked for those armored cars carrying a shotgun.
Tough motherfucker, man.
Yo, she was, I miss her dearly, and I love her dearly, but know. I was always terrified as shit of her, man. She could kill you with, like, without even thinking about it.
That's a real...
But, So the Roots Picnic was my first meeting with those guys, and then there were a few... VH1 things like Divas, I think we did, where they would just like tack us onto, you know, they just add the Dap Kings horns onto their whatever they were doing. And that happened a few times. And then I remember there was a gig with Amy. We were playing the Highline Ballroom, I think it was.
Right.
And Quest was there for the whole gig on the side of the stage. And then afterwards up in the dressing room, he asked us if we wanted to do that Al Green record. And then the Al Green record is where I got, Rich Nichols, the Roots manager at the time, rest in peace. He was there for all those recording sessions and took a liking to us. And then when the Tonight Show came around, he remembered us from that session. Mm-hmm. And that's really how that gig came to me. It was through that Al Green session and Rich remembering us.
So, like, with all these common threads, what do you think the most important thing about how you handle your business or how you are with people or all those things? Or what would you say to someone else, you know, like in terms of advice about how to get somewhere? Just be cool, be professional, show up on time. Like, what would you say?
Well, yeah, all three of those things you said are very important. I think it's... you know, being a being a successful musician is like gumbo. You know, there's a bunch of different ways to go about it. Mm-hmm. You know, in my case, I can really only speak about, you know, what my approach has been. It's those things you said, you know, certainly like, you have to be the type of person that people want to be around. You know, that's kind of more important almost than like even how you play.
Especially if and you're on tour, right? I mean, on a bus with someone for a million hours.
I mean, it's just like, it's a weird, absurd situation that you'd never would be forced to like live in bunks with like a bunch of other adults, you know,
right.
And smelling their feet and whatever else, you know. But you got, you have to be the type of person that you can, that people want to be around. And really, like, you kind of have to be the type of person that, like, elevates things. Like, you want to be the type of person that's, like, that when you walk into a room or you have your horn in your hands, that you're lifting things up, you know. And then once you put a group of, like, 10 people like that together, then all of a sudden there's some magic happening.
I hear you.
But, yeah, of course, like, you don't want to be late, you know. That's that would just be ridiculous in my mind. You know, there's that joke, how do you get a musician to complain? And the punchline is give him a gig, you know. musicians are funny people, man. Like, to me, it makes no sense. Like, if someone says 8 o'clock, it's the downbeat. Like, I'm shooting to be there at 7:30.
Yeah.
You know, so I can get relaxed, get comfortable, get my horn out, have a cup of coffee, take a leak, whatever I got to do. So that 8 o'clock rolls around, like, I'm in the game, you know, I'm ready to rip.
And you're a horn player, so it's easier. Like, if you're a guitarist, you should shoot earlier, you know?
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't believe in being late.
Any big city living, like, travel is its entirely own thing. So it's like, you want to get that out of the way, get to the gig and like breathe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. 8 o'clock does not mean 7:55, man.
Hell no.
Cause then you're going to freak someone out. Someone's going to get freaked out. Yeah.
You want to keep everything, like, everybody feeling good. Just you, again, you're just trying to elevate, you know. Mm-hmm. Anytime I have a saxophone in my hand, I'm trying to think I'm on, like, 110%. Like, I'm trying to push myself to focus and concentrate and be, like, better than my best. Anytime I pick up an instrument, that's my intention, is to I'm never, ever half-assing, ever.
Yeah, man.
So I think if you have that kind of focus and that drive and you can be the type of person that people enjoy being around, you know, eventually, and you know, you're not too pushy or not too laid back or whatever, you're gonna get there.
Yeah, man, and you gotta persevere, right? I remember you telling me that you slammed your hand in the window because it fell right on your hand, and then you had to do the gigs.
Yeah.
And then they made you solo just to get you.
Yeah. And then, you know, we were doing, I think it was 2 summers ago, we were in Europe with the Roots and Usher. Mm-hmm. And I thought I got a bug bite on the tour bus because I got this big red mark on the back of my leg, right? And it's real itchy and weird. I'm sorry if it's TMI, but it ended up being Lyme. I got Lyme disease.
Jesus.
And it was like there was like a knife in the back of my leg and someone was just turning it all day long. It was the most pain because I couldn't get any treatment. They don't have Lyme in Europe. So I went to one of these doctors and they were like, here, put this cream on it. Like, don't be a baby. You know, that was their vibe, you know. And I was like, I'm in so much pain. They didn't know what my problem was. But anyway, so I'm like, we're playing this gig with Usher and there's like a lot of steps, you know. It's not just playing the parts. It's like, you know, steps.
Yeah, like dancing steps.
And I can barely walk, you know, but like every time this step would come up, I would just like I had this like, I don't know what it was, like a piece of leather or something. I would just put it in my mouth and just like chew on it for like a second,
tourniquet.
Get myself amped up and then just start stepping. It's like, oh, and it just hurt. It hurt like you wouldn't believe.
Civil War pain meds.
Man, it was nuts. And this is the thing is like, you know, I think I've missed, we did 6 years of tapings before the world just ended.
Right.
I think I missed one day or something like that.
Wow.
You know, because I was so deathly ill, I couldn't like get out of bed. But I, you know, there were a bunch of times where I was like really sick and you just swallow the pill and just go to work.
Oh, man. Who'd you get? Didn't you get Wayne to cover for you?
Yes.
Because I never go on Facebook, man. I mean, why?
It was Wayne. Yeah. Yep.
But I remember him posting something.
I missed one day. It was, Wayne Escoffrey.
That's hard though. I mean, I feel like it's even harder for horn players, drummers, because the physicality of those instruments it's like you have to, I mean, you're breathing the whole time.
Yeah, it's no, like it's crazy. If you have like a lung thing or a cough, like having a cough and playing saxophone, that's really fun.
Even just if you're fatigued, like a lot, you know, that's tough.
But. Yeah, it's just, it's when I put on the big boy hat and I, you know, and I'm doing that 110% thing, you just, the music kind of like takes over and you stop feeling sick for those 60 seconds that you're playing.
Right.
You know? So it can actually be good, but, you just gotta be tough and just show up, you know.
This is a totally unrelated, kind of related to the last thing we said, but, how much music do you think you play on the Fallon show, like timed?
Oh, not very much at all, man.
Right.
That's one of the tricky things about that gig is it's especially coming from the Dap Kings and
right.
You know,
just epic.
Yeah, just like 2.5 hour like sweat factories.
Yeah, right.
You know, where you just literally like I would time like a sip of beer in the middle of the show. Like, all right, I have 10 seconds to run over and have a sip, and then you're right back.
You're talking about like 1 2.5 hour set.
Yes.
Yeah, it's insane.
Straight through, and like we're literally playing like the entire time.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, I was playing baritone and
just
stepping,
like wearing an adult diaper.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Yeah, it's not a game, man. That gig was not a game. Anyway, so to go from that to the Tonight Show, which is it's difficult in a different way, just the inherent pressure of just, you know, knowing that there's millions of people watching and
there's no time to get loose.
No, there's none of that, and there's nowhere to warm up there, so like I can't like take my horn out and get warm. Like there's like I'm in a room full of people, you know.
Yeah. And as soon as you hit a note, it's just gonna be perfect. Like you've been sitting there for 15 minutes, and you're like, and then, all right, here goes this G sharp. Like,
yeah, bam. And a lot of times it's a lot of times I'm playing, you know, 2 or 3 instruments on a daily. Mm-hmm. You know,
oh man,
there's a lot of days where I play every instrument I own. You know. Between the show and a recording session or a gig after the show, you know.
Harp.
But anyway, yeah, right, you dig.
Or a pillow. Somebody pillow. Said you were playing a pillow.
Yeah, no, it's pretty Bernie. You got to check it out. He does Don't Stand So Close to Me.
Out. Yeah, that's fun.
And he's on pillow. And then Dave Guy plays shoe, I think.
He's on pillow.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm playing the pillow. There's another one where I play spray bottle.
It was kind of badass.
A spray bottle?
Yeah, spray bottle. We did this thing for that Global Citizens concert where it was like everybody.
Yep. You're lucky you have a dog and not a cat. Your cat would never talk to you ever again if it saw you on national television with a spray bottle.
Now, Ian's a cat person, man. Ian was he was a roommate of mine years ago, and and he had cats. And you know, he knew Horsey, Jake.
I was gonna say, is this pre-Horsey?
No, Horsey was there. Horsey had words.
I was there for all the Horsey years.
Horsey had words with Ian.
Oh yeah, Horsey did not dig me. Horsey did not like me one bit. It
took her 6 months to even look at me.
Yeah, right. I hear you.
She was a tough cookie, man.
Well, we got a dog now, Ramsey Lewis, the second.
Nice.
Yeah, Ramsey's cool as hell.
He's great.
Last time I was at your place.
My wife is really a dog person.
Last time I was at your place, I kept throwing that ball up the hill, and that dog would just continue. That was the best game he could imagine.
Yeah, he's just turned 12, so he's going up that hill a little bit slower these days.
Yeah, that's about the age.
Yeah.
But
where were we? I forget. I digressed.
No, I don't think I think this is where it is. I think this is where my mind is. I'm kind of like, dig. I kind of have wet brain right now, this whole thing. You know, due to me having a small child and COVID and all that thing. But we're doing the best we can, and we're trying to educate someone, or at least tell our story.
Yeah.
If nothing else. This is going to be kind of interesting. I know that you said you don't read on this gig, and I knew that because we've talked about it. But, you know, in the past, I know you've done a bunch of gigs. Well, first of all, I know that you're a really, really good reader. Do you still get called to do any of those gigs where you have to read fly shit?
Yes.
Okay.
And it does occasionally happen at the show.
Oh, you mean if an artist comes in?
Yeah, sometimes it's very rare, but sometimes something will get thrown at me and it's strangely, I always thought that the reading thing would go away because I don't really do it anymore, but it doesn't. I can still read just about anything. Right.
And you can transpose and you can do all that.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to, like keys are irrelevant.
That's unbelievable. I mean, to me, it's like magic.
Oh, transposing?
No, just like being able to read as well as you can, because I've seen you do it.
Well, it's the classical background.
Yeah.
Because it really, like, mainly I deal with eighth notes and triplets. And, like, that compared to what, you know, Prokofiev. Like,
yeah, exactly.
You know, so it makes the you know, right. da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da-ba-da, that makes it look like child's play.
Yeah, exactly, right.
You know, so that, I think learning, having that initial, you know, bitch slap of dealing with Bach and Mozart,
exactly.
and Telemann and right. all that, you know.
Yeah.
That's music is so dense.
Right.
So yeah, that's kind of where I got it from, and certainly a great, you know, skill to have in your back pocket, you know, when it comes up.
I would imagine. I was just curious how much you got called for, but it seems like you actually do that now. Yeah, I mean.
Yeah.
It's,
I mean, you know, really the muscle that I exercise more than anything now is like memorizing. Is,
right.
You know, trying to memorize a massive amount of music in a short amount of time.
Right. I can see that.
That's really tough, but getting better at it.
Let's move on to, you know, your record label. You started a record label, mm-hmm. you and Adam Scone, and mm-hmm. Explain that. I know there's two sides to it, right? Is it all Rondette, right? But isn't there a jazz side and another side, or no?
That was the initial intention. Okay. Is an umbrella that me and Adam Scone own,
mm-hmm.
and then I was going to run Rondette Jazz, mm-hmm. and then he was going to run Rondette Records. And Rondette Records is going to be kind of just more whatever he felt like putting out, like right. His crazy organ records or right. a blues record or
right.
rock or, you know, folk, whatever. It could be anything. And then the jazz thing was going to be mine and be very intentionally, like, you know, hard bop oriented.
Mm-hmm.
The long and short of that is that I still run the jazz side of things with a lot of input from Scone.
Okay.
It's been pretty quiet lately, the label. I think the last record I put out was a John Doakes record.
Mm-hmm.
I have a bunch of stuff in the can that I want to put out, but it's just everything just keeps getting in the way.
Right. I can't imagine
but
why.
Yeah, it's yeah, right. And Scone has ended up putting out a bunch of stuff with Daptone and on his own with his he has an imprint called Flamingo Time Records.
Oh, nice.
One of the coolest looking labels you'll ever see.
Oh man,
label.
I gotta look.
It's pretty sick, man. Flamingo Time. You gotta check it out.
Flamingo
anyway, so
time.
Scone hasn't really gotten the Rondette Records thing off the ground. So I'm not sure if he's going to or not. But in the meantime, I'm just forging ahead with the jazz thing, and it's, you know, it's a labor of love, man. There's no money in it at all.
Right.
And it's probably cost me money.
Yeah, but you know.
But I'm, you know,
keeps you sane.
Yeah, it is, and it's fun, man. It appeases my control freakness, you know, because
right.
I do everything, the website, you know, the engineering, the mixing, the mastering, the production, you know, everything.
How do you deal with write-ups and things like that, NPR?
There's a couple of different ways you can do it. There, you can either hire somebody, which costs way more than radio print.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, I was lucky enough that, and we've done this a few times, lucky enough that one of the print publicists that I hired in the past gave me their mailing list. Well, wow. Along with all the emails and all that stuff. And now again, or not again, the,
why would they do that?
One of the things with that business is really, it's all about the relationships. You know, if you have a great publicist, they're great because they know a bunch of people.
Yeah, that's all it is. Yeah, I mean.
It's not because they have a long list. So I've sent out huge mailings and gotten traction on records
mm-hmm.
and sent out huge mailings and gotten zero traction. So it's, you know, it really boils down to like who you know at the stations and magazines and stuff and how much time you're willing to spend emailing and phone calling.
Right. You know? In terms of the business stuff, besides kind of what you talked about, you know, showing up on time. I mean, I'm imagining some of the things you do. I mean, I know that you've always been good at saving money. I don't know if that, even when you didn't have a lot, like when we were all, you know, just gigging five nights a week, trying to make it work. I know you've always been really organized and you've always been a really cool person in terms of you got along with a lot of different groups of people. Never seemed like an egotistical guy. I know these just seem like compliments, but do you have anything that you often tell people if they ask what's important about networking or kind of doing this thing?
Short answer, I don't really have like a go-to advice thing. I try to, like, if someone is asking me about business, mm-hmm. like, say, for instance, like a college kid, my answer to a college kid is going to be different than a high school kid, or just kind of depends on who's asking. But I'll often just tell people that, you know, to be cool. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I think that's really tricky when you're, if you're in a position where you're asking somebody a question like that, it means you're trying to find your way still. Mm-hmm. One of the things I that has really helped me out is being specific about what it is that you want out of music. Mm-hmm. You know, like what is it? What do you want to do? Like, do you want to teach? You want to tour? You want to be a recording guy? Do you want to be on television? What do you want? And for me, like, you know, the my stepping stone gig that opened up all these doors for me was really, you know, again, it was the Dap Kings. And that was a gig that I hustled. Like, I remember I heard it was when we were playing with the Hot Pants, you and me, Adam.
Yeah.
And I heard about this band called the Dap Kings, and they were playing a gig, I think, at the Mercury Lounge or something like that. Mm-hmm. So I knew, you know, Sugarman.
And Al. Yeah, Al probably got you with... introduced you to Sugarman, right?
Or not? Yeah, or Scone. Well, I knew Neil
right
before that, but we weren't like tight or anything. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I called him up, was like, "Hey man, I want to come hang. I heard you guys are cooking, you know." Mm-hmm. And I just, every time the band played in the city, I would go and just hang and make sure I got backstage and got to hang with Sharon and talk to Gabe. And I wasn't pushy. Mm-hmm. I wasn't like, "Hey man, like, I'm great. You should call me." You know, it wasn't. I just like hung a bunch of times, watched the set, you know, didn't really say much, but like hung out, got drinks with people, just be mellow and be part of the scene. Mm-hmm. And then after enough times, you know, I told Neil, I was like, "Hey man, if you're in a spot, like, you know, call me. I'd love to do it."
Right.
And then it happened to, like, maybe a month or two after that, they called me and said, "Hey, we need somebody to go to Montreal today."
Right.
Do you play baritone? And I was like, "Of course." And I think at that point I'd never even touched a baritone sax.
Right.
But, so I hung up, and the car was picking me up in like 2 hours right. to drive up there. I'd never played that gig ever.
So where did you have a baritone? Did you have to get
I just
one?
Borrowed one. Yeah, I think I got one from Matt Hong or something like that.
Oh, Hong has one?
I think, yeah, he's got like contra bass everything.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, he's crazy doubler, Matt Hong, because he's a Broadway cat.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you got to do everything on those gigs.
Right. So I got a baritone. They handed me a Discman with like 10 shitty CDs of like live shows.
Right.
And they're like, "We think this is going to be the set, you know, have fun." Mm-hmm. So I learned, you know, 30s tunes or whatever on the way up there, and then hacked my way through it and did a pretty good job. And that was, you know, and then they kept calling me, and then eventually it became my gig. You know, that was a situation where I was like, "Man, I would love to play that music with those musicians." And how, you know, the best way to do that is just to go, become part of that scene.
Right, hang.
In whatever way you can, just mm-hmm. hang.
And especially those guys, I mean, it's really all about the hang.
Yeah.
I mean, I believe that that's probably true with 90% of all musicians. But especially that gig is a family, you know? Mm-hmm. Don't you think?
Yeah, it's very tight-knit, man.
Yeah.
I remember some of the subs that came and went, you know?
Right.
They're always like, "Man, it's like soul camp."
Nice.
You know, because all we did was like listen to soul music and hang. That was it. That was like the vibe. Like we ate, slept, and shit soul music all day long. Every single day.
You know? Soul food, soul music.
Yeah, you dig? We did a tour once in the States where we would drive like hours out of the way to hit these like certain like church soul spots. Mm-hmm. That was kind of our vibe. So we would find these places that would have like, you know, soul brunch or whatever, and we'd go and just have barbecue for breakfast. Yeah. You know, we all got super fat and sick.
Oh, man.
It was fun.
No, but that food is delicious. I know. I used to do a lot of those gigs, and, you know, it's just, you don't always, you know, feel great about what you ate after the fact, but it was great going down. You did. When you're in the bathroom, you're kind of like, ah.
Yeah. One of the hardest things about being on the road is eating, for sure.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Well, I mean, I got, I guess, one more question before we open this up to the audience. No. for questions. So, you know, as we talked about, you're versatile. in sound, and I believe that it's only because you love all these kinds of musics, and that's probably going to be your answer. But you know, I don't believe that you learned how to play Maceo stuff because, you know, you thought that you were going to get a funk gig, or that, you know, I guess that's where I'm going with it. But I mean, it seems like it's been really important for you to be able to just put that hat on for whatever you're doing and be authentic. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Well, there's a very important point to make here is that even though I wear different hats, I've really tried to find a sound and a way of approaching the saxophone, I guess you call it a style,
mm-hmm.
That works within whatever realm I'm doing, and I don't change my sound. Like, I'm not a...
Right.
I don't play with a different sound when I'm playing R&B than when I'm playing jazz. Like, it's the same mouthpiece, same horn, same setup. And I think that's important because it makes you identifiable. You know, if someone, and you know, here, and getting back to, you know, that what do you want out of music? And for me, like I wanted to have a career where I'm playing the music that I love, you know? So, that's kind of how I intentionally like went about trying to get certain gigs, you know, in my mind, like it's almost like you just do it out of will, you know, but I, you know, I'm not really like a high tech, like, a super advanced harmony jazz player. Like, my jazz is pretty grits and gravy, for lack of a better term. It's pretty like soulful and simple. And
yeah, I mean, you know, you're more from the Cannonball, like, you know, Stanley T camp, right?
Yes. As right. opposed to like, late Coltrane.
Right. Or, I got you.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I can't do the acrobatics that a lot of these, a lot of my contemporaries and younger kids are doing these days.
Yeah.
And that's not something I aspire to.
No, exactly. You know?
I feel like maintaining that voice, though, is the real difficult part of any instrument.
And, you know, so far it's for whatever reason, it's working for me. But I, you know, I've tried to put myself in positions where I know that what I do is going to work, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Where I'm not like forced to play something or forced to be in a bag that's not my thing, because I'm not gonna succeed.
Oh, I'm with you, man.
You know.
Yeah. No, it'd be hard.
You know? There's some gigs where I've gotten called for to do things, and I'm like, nah, that's not my thing. Even though it might be a huge gig or it would be monetarily good, that's not a direction that I want to go in. So I've said no to some things that were probably stupid to say no to financially. But would have put me in a weird career path, I felt like, you know.
Yeah, maybe it would have helped you in the very immediate future, but maybe not in the master plan, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you have any random touring advice? Because you have done so much of that. I mean, I've done a fair share, you know. I mean, compared to you, you seem like you're always on the road, man.
I remember when I first got the Tonight Show gig, which would have been 6+ years now. I was like, oh, you know, oh joy, I don't have to tour anymore.
Right.
Right? And that was true for about a year. Cause yeah. When we first signed on, the Roots made it real clear. They're like, look, we just want you to do the TV show. You're not going to do the tour dates with us. Like, we don't want a horn section on the road.
Those guys work so much, man.
And that lasted about a year.
Yeah.
And then they were like, okay, you're doing all the tour dates now. It's amazing. I love touring with those guys, but it's a lot.
Yeah. Man.
It's a lot. It's like, we work Monday through Friday at Fallon, and then we're usually out Saturday, Sunday, fly back Monday or some
right.
arrangement like that. And then every time there's a break from the show, like a week or 2 weeks,
mm-hmm.
we're gone, like Europe or somewhere.
Yeah. It seems like that's always the case with you.
It's pretty intense, man. Yeah. So usually we get like a week off in the summer and then a few days off for Christmas, and that's kind of it, you know?
Right.
So yeah, I, and then, you know, before that with the Dap Kings, and I toured with a bunch of other groups as well, but,
right. All in different situations, thing, you know, but what do you think in terms of,
well, it's kind of like age specific. So when I was young and impervious, I didn't really care too much about anything. I just kind of like was out there having fun and
right.
playing the gigs and trying to make some money and get better. And then as you get older, you kind of start to get a little more fussy about what you eat and trying to make sure you get some rest so you don't get sick.
Sure.
So, you know, there's certain things you can do, like, And just in terms of like forcing yourself to take naps and, you know, that kind of thing. Cause you're not gonna sleep. Like right. A lot of times we'll play a gig and then our lobby call will be like 3 a.m.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Know, totally.
To get a 5:30 flight somewhere.
Mm-hmm. That just destroys you.
You're not going to sleep.
Yeah.
Like maybe you get an hour on the plane or something. And then you have a little stretch of time when you get to the hotel right. before the gig. Yeah.
Unless some dude's like got his hand on your shit or something, you know, like, like, you know, the middle guy in the plane, you know?
Yeah, yeah. 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 And we're flying coach, you know, unless it's not any like fancy first class or nothing, you know,
nap mentality life.
Yeah, so, there you go.
You can't ever go to sleep. Like, you just have to take a nap. You have to.
Yeah, you're just constantly power napping.
Yeah, you're like a stealth fighter pilot, you know? Like, yeah. You go to sleep for 1 hour. You're like, okay.
It's like sniper training.
Yeah. I think as I've gotten older, I try to look out for myself a little bit more. And, mm-hmm. you know, that being, you know, with moderation as well, too. You know?
Of course.
I'm certainly having fun out there, but.
I know.
Do you ever find time to, like, shed new shit?
Right now I am.
Yeah. So that, I mean, but because that's probably kind of exciting because there's just no time for that. You maintain,
bro.
You learn what you need for the gigs.
I have a list of shit like this long, you know, that I've been wanting to work on for years.
Yeah.
Years and years and years. So I'm finally like, I finally have time right now
to
shed. And it's been unbelievable, man. It feels so great. But no, I'm busy to the point where all I can do is like maintain.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. Maintain what I have. And I you know, I practice away from the horn a lot, just like thinking about lines and 12 keying in my mind.
Yep.
So I am actually like my harmony is expanding, but it's just at a much slower pace than if I got the horn in my hands for 5-6 hours a day.
I've always wanted to do a podcast episode on that alone, just like practicing away from your instrument. I think Coleman talked about it a little bit. I think it was a section that was called Thinking Music. And
yeah.
It's just like you should always, you know, whether on your bus, a train,
oh,
like
George
you
can Coleman
practice. It's
probably
it's your
it's forefront in your mind. Like if you hear if you hear a car horn go by, like dun, I'm like, what interval was that? You know what I mean? You know, I'm always thinking of something like
that.
Thinking about
that
your
was
training.
A fifth, Ian. Man, we could do this all night, except we can't really because we're locked in our rooms, and it's time to do other things. But anyway, we're gonna split, but. I think you got a new record out, right? You want to talk about it just for a second before we say goodbye?
Sure. It's actually coming out in November, I believe. It's for Cellar Live, which is a label based in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
I recorded it at Rudy Van Gelder's studio, which is, you know, for those people that don't know, Rudy Van Gelder's is the kind of the mecca of jazz recording studios.
That must have been really cool.
It was heavy, man. Just walking through the door was heavy.
History, man.
Great band. I wrote most of the music for the session, and there are a couple interesting sidelines to this. Starting in the 70s when CTI started recording in Van Gelder's, he built booths.
Mm.
And they never turned back. So they threw away like all the gobos.
Oh.
They threw away most of the ribbon mics.
From
they threw
that
away
big
all the
live
stuff.
Room, yeah.
Yeah, they threw away all the stuff that you would want to record everybody in the same room because they started isolating everybody. So I did a date. I did a record there at Rudy's the day before my record date where everybody was isolated. And I had a really tough time in there because, you know, I don't like wearing headphones when I'm recording and it just sounded funny to me, you know? So I begged them, I begged them to let me set up everybody in the same room and you know, obviously there was pushback because they haven't done that since like the 70s.
They're like, why would you want to do that?
Yeah. Why would you want to do that when we can just hit record and it'll sound great, you know? But anyway, I convinced them and we all set up facing each other and it was real messy. But because of that, we got to use the actual piano from like a Love Supreme and all that. Cause they have two pianos. They have like a 10-foot Steinway D, which is in a booth. And then they have the 6.5-foot Steinway B, which is, you know, the original everything piano, the piano that's on all those records, you know?
Yeah, man.
And that was it. Cause you know, you just, that piano has a certain sound to it, man.
Is that Jeremy like on that too?
No, it's Rick Germanson.
Oh, great.
Just has a certain vibe to it, man. Just that you could just tell it's that piano. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And just having everybody in the same room, the drums, you know, that sound incredible in that big space.
Totally.
So I'm really excited about the sound of it. Rudy was always wanted to be cutting edge. So when digital came out, he literally got a dumpster delivered to his driveway and threw away all his tape machines. He had like 10 tape machines.
Fuck.
He literally just like threw them into a dumpster, which makes me cry.
Yeah. See, that's the time machine shit. Like, you want to go back and to that day and grab a bunch of Studers or Ampex.
I know, man. I know. He was using Ampex.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
But he kept the Scully lathe, so he still has that in the studio. So anyway, it was real heavy for me, man. It's, you know, being such a ardent fan of jazz records, and specifically the records recorded at Rudy Van Gelder's, it was like just a like one of those like pinch me moments. Like, I can't believe I'm fucking standing in Rudy Van Gelder's right now, about to make a record. You know,
totally, man.
It was great. It was really heavy. So yeah, I'm excited about it. It's gonna be cool. I think it's gonna be called The Lowdown, and it's a tribute to the late great Lawrence Low Leathers.
Oh yeah, man. That's so sad. Yeah. I know. Yeah, you guys were tight too.
Yes, he was a dear friend. Miss him.
Yeah, man. So let's say goodbye for now and eat a late dinner or whatever we're going to do. Delivery might still work. Probably not where you are right now, right? Do you have a lot of delivery options? No?
No.
All right. Well, you can cook. And yeah, man. So and I think you're going to be doing a new video for the site, right?
Yes, it's almost done.
Ooh, I can't wait.
Yeah,
I don't even want to know what the topic is. I want to be surprised.
Oh, I'm not going to tell you. No, I'm not going to tell you.
I want to be surprised.
Yeah.
All right, brother. It was great talking, and we will see you next time. So it's goodbye for now.
All right, gentlemen. Thank you for having me, and you know, all you out there, all you people out there listening, you know, be good to each other.
Questions, comments, episode ideas, hate mail, you can get in touch with us by contact form, email, or voicemail, all of which are available at our website, theperformerspathway.com. If one of your questions or topics makes it into the podcast, with your consent, of course, you'll receive a shiny new $10 gift card for use at mymusicmasterclass.com. That's our sister website, which contains over 600 original educational videos from your musical heroes. So we look forward to hearing from you.